Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2016. Lecture 24, delivered on April 14, 2016. The title of this lecture is Cost of Capital.
Today, Cost of Capital. This is the last lecture before the exam. The exam, too, is next week, this day, next week, 1 week from today. And on Tuesday, we will review for the exam. And then on Thursday, we will take the exam. We will have the exam. And again, this is the last lecture. And this closes the chapter on debt, equity, and all of that. First and foremost, again, as I have brought up on numerous occasions, and in fact even tested you on the idea, debt is cheaper than equity, no doubt about it, almost all the time. The question persists, if debt is cheaper than equity, then why would a company have common stock, raise money by selling common stock? What would be the motive if debt is cheaper than equity? Why wouldn't companies just borrow when they have need for capital funds? Part of the clue here lies in something I actually saw myself. I've seen it in my own business, and I saw it before when I was a consultant. It didn't really hit me too much at the time. But the deal is this, that as a company acquires more debt in its capital structure, it will tend to become a riskier company. Because obviously it's going to have to pay more interest expense out of operating income. And so if operating income swings, because revenue swings too much, well, the company might go, operating income might not be sufficient to cover the interest. In other words, EBIT would be below interest, and therefore the company would just immediately be bankrupt. Right there, that's the end of the game. So companies would like to stay, keep a distance between how much interest they pay and how much their operating income is. And certainly lenders are going to get nervous if a company acquires too much debt because it becomes riskier. However, what really happens in the real world, and I'll give you an example of this. Now, these numbers are not quite right. I said them yesterday in class, and I've checked my books, and I was a little wrong, and I can't remember exactly, but let me give you sort of the basic outline of what happens. I look for a line of credit for my company. I will build inventory in the months where there are no shows, no exhibitions. As I've told you before, I'm a landscape photography artist. And I build my inventory in the winter and in the late fall and winter. And then I start selling at the shows through the summer. So what I do is I ask, all right, my bank, will you please extend me a line of credit? And I will borrow on this to build my inventory, and then in the lean months, and then in the fat months, I will pay it off. And they're sure, here's the schedule. And it was not just, we will charge you this interest rate. The way it worked, and this is the way it worked for many companies, is we will, for the first $3,000, it was 8.99%. For $3,000 to $5,000, it was 12.59%. For $5,000 to $20,000, it was 18.59%. So in other words, as I borrowed more, my marginal cost of debt rose. And so ultimately, it's not just debt is cheaper than equity. Well, it's cheaper than equity up to the point where it gets more expensive than equity. So as I had mentioned at some point, I believe, there were, and I will zoom this in a little bit. There were these two financial economists, Modigliani and Miller. They set forth this proposition. It was kind of a ludicrous proposition, but they were challenging the theory to answer it. If debt is cheaper than equity, then why do we see companies that have equity in their capital structure? The obvious answer, as I pointed out, is that debt is not always cheaper than equity. So the first thing I want to do is I'm going to just throw out a term, weighted average cost of capital. Weighted average cost of capital. It's, in other words, the percent of debt in your capital structure times the cost of debt plus the percent of equity in your capital structure times the cost of equity. So in other words, the WACC, weighted average cost of capital, is W sub D times the cost of debt after taxes, and I've talked about that, plus the weight of equity, W sub E, times the cost of equity in your capital structure. That's the weighted average cost of capital, the WACC. It is, for some companies, used as the discount rate. The WACC is used as the discount rate. Screw the capital asset pricing model and all that. We'll use the WACC. There's some reason to believe there's some legitimacy to it, but there's also some reason to say that's not really a good idea because the WACC represents the cost of the company. It doesn't necessarily represent the cost of the risk of a project if you're analyzing. But you'll see in the textbook, they'll say, well, some companies discount their cash flows by 1 plus WACC. So free cash flow 1 over 1 plus WACC plus free cash flow 2 over 1 plus WACC squared, et cetera, all that. Setting that aside, this is what I mean by WACC. Okay, so now I'm going to draw a picture, just a little graph here, to set this discussion in motion. And I'm going to have you, as I did last time, do some of the analysis with me here. Okay, let's say that this is the percent of debt on the horizontal axis. And this is your weighted average cost of capital, WACC, on the vertical axis. Now, the percent of debt would go from 0% on up to 100%. Now, if I have no debt, the weight of debt in my capital structure is zero, then my weighted average cost of capital would be nothing plus zero plus 100% times the cost of equity. So in other words, the y-intercept of this WACC line would be K sub E, the cost of equity. If I have 0% debt, then my weighted average cost of capital is the same as my cost of equity. On the other hand, if I have 100% debt in my capital structure, then the formula would be 100% times the after-tax cost of debt plus zero. So at 100% debt, here's K sub DAT, which would be lower than K sub E, at 100%, we have a point right there. And so the WACC line would be a straight downward sloping line from K sub E on the y-axis down to K sub D at 100% debt. That would be the WACC function. But in the real world, it's not. And this was what Modigliani and Miller were talking about. Logically, if this were the true WACC function, it would be this line. But because as a company acquires more debt, it starts to get the lenders charging at higher interest rates on debt. Eventually, this WAC curve actually turns upward. So this would be the theoretical WAC. This would be the empirical WAC, the one that would be out there in the real world. Something mighty important here. Hear me well. There is a bottoming out point of the real world WAC. Now, interestingly, when we collect data on different companies and industries, that bottoming out point is at different places. In some cases, you'll have a WAC curve that is, let me draw one real quick here. I'll show you a couple here that you can see. And you're going to see the evidence of this just in a minute here. Not these graphs, but you'll see the evidence of this. Sometimes we'll see the WAC go down, and then it will just swing up at very low percentages of debt. In other words, the debt starts costing more and more money for the last dollar of debt. Earlier and earlier. Other companies have more of a smooth, almost parabolic. And some companies, their weighted average cost of capital keeps falling until they're nearly 100% debt. So the bottoming out point can be at a different percentage for different companies and different industries, a different percentage of debt. But whatever it is, this bottoming out point has a name. It is called the optimal capital structure. The optimal capital structure is the combination of debt and equity that minimizes the weighted average cost of capital. The optimal capital structure is the combination of debt and equity that minimizes the weighted average cost of capital. Sir, do you remember what I said about when I repeat a definition? Is there anything about that that is important? Yeah, write that damn thing down. Hint, hint. Nudge, nudge. Wink, wink. Okay. I'm repeating it because it's important. And if it's important, it's something that I could ask you someday. I'm not saying here. Maybe in 30 years when I run into you on a street, I get, you know. But it is important to companies. They care about this. Now, how you find it. Realistically, there are two ways that it happens. And honestly, a lot of companies feel their way in the dark over a period of years. And they have these gurus figuring out, well, what's our cost, weighted average cost of capital now? What was it before? All that, blah, blah, blah. Okay. But there are some very powerful models out there that can help using some very heavy-duty mathematics and theory. You can find it, too. You can also look at an industry and say, okay, but one way or the other, once a company has its optimal capital structure, it's going to hold to that with a vice grip. It's going to stay at its optimal capital structure. This can mean, as a matter of fact, I've seen offerings of common stock that where they just said, we are selling common stock so that we can pay off some of our debt to return to our optimal capital structure. In other words, they had too much debt, too little equity to be at the bottoming point. So they're just going to sell some equity, and they have more equity that way, and buy back and pay off debt so they have less debt so that they're moving back toward their weighted average cost of capital. Similarly, there will be companies that will issue debt and buy back some of their stock simply because they were off the bottoming out point and they want to move back to it. Companies will do that. But they will do even more than that. They will do even more than that. You have decided that you are going to be my project manager. So you have this project, it's gone through the NPV analysis, and it's a go and all that kind of stuff. And let's say that my optimal capital structure is 25% debt, 75% equity, okay? Well, you don't care about things like that. All you care about is getting this project going. And you come to me one day and you say, "Sir, I would like to have a dollar for this project." Okay? A dollar? Okay, yeah. So, I could just reach into the company funds and pull out, hey, here's a dollar. I got a damn dollar right here. Here, yeah, there you go. But I'm not going to do that. You reach for that dollar, I'm going to say, that. I am actually going to step back from you back to my table. I have two giant boxes here. One with an E on it and one with a D on it. I'm going to open the box that has the D on it, and I'm going to pull out a quarter. And then I'm going to open the box with the E on it, and I'm going to pull out three quarters. And then I'm going to take those four quarters together, and I'm going to give them to you. That's how the project will be funded. Because if I just give you a dollar from either one of the drawers, I blow my optimal capital structure because now I've got a project that is off the optimal capital structure. Do you understand the idea there? You have to do it that way. Otherwise, you're just going to blow your optimal capital structure because your company is nothing but the projects that it's making money on or getting underway. So unless you are funding projects on the capital structure, optimal capital structure, you won't keep the company on the optimal capital structure. Now, the thing that it is, though, that it's a little bit more complicated than that. Nothing big, but I do want to bring up the point that you're going to have your after-tax cost of debt, but it's actually going to be in tiers of cost. As I said, the lenders will lend you at a good rate for the first tranche of money. Then they're going to up it for the second tranche, etc. So you're not always going to get a simple K-A-T sub D. It will go in stages. But now the other side of it is, this is the debt. On the other side of it is the equity. Now remember that there are three flavors of equity. There is your internally generated equity, your profit from operations, your what we call free cash flow. Your free cash flow from operations. Okay? You'll have that there. And then you will, if you've run through your money that you've made, you could sell some preferred stock. And if you run through, and you don't want to do that, and most of the examples I'm going to give you, we won't talk about the preferred stock avenue. But then you will go to your sell some more stock, case of M. So there would be actually three levels that would go on. Your cheapest debt, I would pair with my cheapest source of equity. That would be K sub D 1 AT with K sub S. And then probably I would run through my first debt level first And then I still had some profit. It would really depend upon how much profit the company had made. But then I would probably go to my next level of debt, still burning up what I had left in profit from the company for that year. And once I had burned up my profit and I was on debt level two, then I'd start selling common stock. It's kind of complicated. I used to teach this. I used to have an exercise with this, but too many people tried to slash the tires on my car, so I stopped doing the math of it. Let me tell you a background on this. I talked to you about offerings of common stock. And I simplified it a lot. Well, you have your private placements, and then you have your public offerings. You got your Form 10, blah, blah, blah. And your big, huge IPO or your big, huge public offering is on Form S-1, the classic grand public offering of common stock. Raise as much money as you want. Go through hell getting the SEC to qualify it. Pay millions of dollars to accountants and lawyers and consultants. But actually, there's a twist on the S-1 that is very common with large corporations. It's called a shelf registration. A company that is very large will actually register on Form 1 a massive amount of common stock to sell in a public offering. But it won't sell all of it at once. It'll keep it on the shelf, and as it needs more new equity funds for projects, it'll pull handfuls of the common stock off the shelf and sell it. That's called a shelf registration. SEC, we're going to register 50 million shares of common stock to sell at $10 a share. But we're not going to sell it all at once. We're going to sell only 15 million right now. But we're going to keep the other in reserve so that when I have run through debt on the first tier and equity that I've internally generated, my profit, and then when I've run through debt on my second tier and equity, I've burned up all my profit, then I can use debt that is more expensive and new equity, just pull it off the shelf and sell it. The shelf registration, Microsoft does it. And realistically, a lot of companies do it this way. That way, they use debt that's cheap and their cheapest equity, what they've earned through operations. Then they step up to the plate with their next level of debt. And then they use that and they burn up whatever's left of their profits that they've got to use for operations that they haven't given out as dividends. And then when they run through that, they will go out and sell more common stock. Like I said, don't sweat too much about the details of that, but just know that that's how it's done. Real world-wise. Now the question burns down. This isn't hard to do. I mean, suppose that you're in the 30% tax bracket. Your cost of debt is 8%. Your cost of equity overall, let's say, is 15%. Your optimal capital structure where you sit is 40% debt, 60% equity. And I'm just giving you an example. So your weighted average cost of capital, WACC, would be your cost of debt after taxes times the weight of debt plus your cost of equity times the weight of equity. So the cost of debt after taxes, I'm going to do that as scratch work here on the side. Your cost of debt after taxes would be 8%. Times 1 minus 0.30, which would be 5.6%. So in other words, my WACC here would be 5.6% times 0.40 plus 15% times 0.60. And I'm just showing you, it's dummy arithmetic, really. There's nothing complicated. I just want to show you an example of it. Really should be able to do that in my head, but Lord knows I'm not going to even try. 5.6 times 0.4 plus 15 times 0.6 equals, so your weighted average cost of capital is going to be 11.24%. There you go. Nothing complicated. Like I said, this is kind of easy stuff. Where it gets interesting, though, is when we look at what do we see in the real world. Here again is one of those magnificent databases from the Stern School at New York University, NYU. Awesome, awesome resources. This is another one you should might want to keep on a bookmark so that you can use this for other classes. Okay. Let me do something here. I'm going to take column B out, just hide it so that try to see if I can get this. Now, I want to point out something here that you'll see in this example. Really? Seriously? Some companies, some analysts actually consider leases as part of debt because there are long-term obligations oftentimes. And if you screw up a lease, well, they're going to come after you just like any other debt holder will. So you'll see leases added in with long-term debt as in calculating your optimal capitals or your debt structure. Now, in this one, this is debt to equity, column E. This is let me find something here. I'm looking for something. I might have pulled up the wrong one. Oh, wait. Let me get another database. I think I grabbed the wrong one. Let me do something real quick here. Debt fundamentals. Pages NYU. I'm looking for another one that was part of this too. Well, maybe that's the one that I wanted. Bear with me 1 minute here. Debt to total assets. Equity. By industry. Let me look. I'm trying to find the one that I want here. Maybe that is the one that I... Maybe it is. That might be the one that I want. Market debt to equity. Well, I can use that, actually. Well, book debt to capital. There it is. That's the one. They're using capital as total assets there. So that's your debt to total assets. So in other words, one minus that would be your equity to total assets. Okay, so now, let me go down through the list and just quickly, just kind of scrolling down, you will see, interestingly, well, this is debt to total capital. There's really not a whole lot of pattern in here. Although you will notice that there are a number of firms that are above 50% debt in their capital structure. Some of them are strikingly well above. In this case, for example, advertising is about 3/4 debt, 1/4 equity. In other words, it's a heavily leveraged industry. They use a lot of debt. They borrow a lot. On the other hand, you'll see things like, for example, electronics. They are weighted toward equity. They're almost a mirror image. About 3/4 of their capital is equity. Engineering and all that, interestingly. And working your way down, where was that? Oh, insurance, interestingly enough, is mostly equity. It's very little debt, oddly enough. And then you've got oil and gas. It's almost all equity. Very little of those companies are debt. I don't know. Do you know why? Can you think of why oil and gas companies, those ginormous evil entities of the universe and all that kind of stuff, why they would be so heavily use equity, have equity and not debt in their total assets? Any reason? Be hard for you to think about. Well, I'll throw this one out to you. Those companies have a massive, massive capital base. I mean, if you've ever gone to an oil and gas facility of one of the big oil and gas companies, it's just like vast as far as the eye can see, with cracking towers and tanks and then you look all over the world, these things, just the vastness of their total asset base. Any debt that they would need at any given time would be tiny compared to the total assets of those corporations. I mean, they could borrow $100 million and it wouldn't even blip their capital structure. There's so much total assets in those monstrous companies. The vastness of them just staggered my mind as I traveled and I saw these things all over the world and even around here. Any of you drive up there, 55 back up to Chicago, and you see that it's kind of pretty at night. It's with the lights twinkling and all that. That thing is actually, but it's so small. It's sort of like, I didn't know they had them that tiny. But that thing is tiny. Literally, when you go to these places, well, one of the things that was back in my time was when there was the first space station called Skylab was up in orbit. It took a photograph down into the Middle East, and it was at night. And that was before all the cities were really lit up. But you could see these giant flare tips just spraying out across the Middle East for hundreds of miles. They were glowing, the flare tips, off the facilities that were spread out there. And in Texas, you could see the same thing. There weren't many lights, but you could see the flare tips clear from outer space. That's how large these companies are. That's how much fixed assets. You can see the evidence of their fixed assets from space. So any debt that they're going to have is going to be minimal compared to the scale of their their total assets. Let me take you down here. I wanted to bring up one. Oh, well, retail automotive. Why is that one high? Does anyone know why that one would be high? Say it. Yeah, you have to put cars on the lot, and you borrow to do that, and then you hope that enough of them will sell that you can pay off the borrowing that you did. Absolutely, that's exactly what it is. And this is what's scary about being in the retail business like that, is every year you have to put enough stuff out there to bring people into your store. And you know damn well most of that's not going to sell. Have you ever gone into a Kohl's or a Macy's or a Bergner's, and you notice all of those clothes they have there? Most of those aren't going to sell, but they have to have that much there so that someone will walk by. You're walking through the lingerie section and you just brush up. Oh, that's nice. Oh, sorry. No, that's me. But the point there is that for everything that you see and buy, you're going to have 100 things that are not going to be bought, but you gotta have them there. Because I don't know which one of those cashmere sweaters you're really gonna buy, so I have to have 80 of them for you. And then, you ungrateful woman, you leave without buying one of them. Oh, I'll come back when there's a sale. Yeah, I'll give you your sale. But that's just the way it is. I put up anywhere from 30 to 50 artworks at a show. They cost a lot to make. I have to lift them up, put them up, and then I have the kids come in and knock some of them over, put their fingers all over, and greasy little... Anyway, so I can sell 3, 4, or 5 of them. That's the thing, is you borrow out the ass and then you hope to God. And that's why the markup, well, that's a ridiculous markup you've got on your stuff. You know, bitch, I have to have that for what I'm doing. So anyway, sorry, it gets a little personal when you're doing. Now, the thing, though, is that you'll see across these industries, if you're thinking about industries, what you're probably seeing is a number that a bunch of companies in the industry, each of them doing their calculations on their calculator, optimal capital structure. So you've got to figure that these debt-to-total asset numbers are pretty darn close to the optimal capital structure for that industry. So what we're seeing here is that there is no one number for the optimal capital structure. It is highly dependent upon the industry. Things in the industry will affect this. Is this an industry that is large, mature, with a huge fixed asset base? Or is this a younger industry? Is this an industry that needs a lot of money to do things? Or is it mostly just people sitting around with doing intellectual property kinds of stuff? Also, there are other things, too, that can affect this. But overall, it is not going to be one number. It's going to be quite dependent upon the industry, the structure of the industry, and also a few other things can affect this, too. But I want to point out something that does affect it. Going back over here just for a minute, and I'll just remind you, I will just remind you of this, that remember your after-tax cost of debt is 1 minus your effective tax rate, your marginal tax rate on the last dollar. Okay, and you heard me bitch about this the last time. Companies with high marginal tax brackets have a lower after-tax cost of debt, so they will tend to use more debt in their capital structure. Their optimal capital structure will be moved more to the right than will be an industry dominated by small upstarts. Okay, that having been said, let's have a look very briefly at tax rates. Effective tax rate. Well, we got to get our taxes down on these corporations because these are the jobs creators. By God, we soak our poor, loving corporations so much on taxes. Well, I'll be damned. Look at some of these numbers. Effective tax rate in advertising, 3.9%. Aerospace, 13.5%. I mean, you don't get up above maybe 25% on any of the corporations in there. Look at these effective tax rates on some of these. Coal, a 0.95% effective tax rate on the coal industry. Let's go down here. I'll show you one that's associated with that. Let's look at down here at oil. Oil and gas production, not even 3% is their effective tax rate. Why is that? Can you explain that? That effective tax rate on coal and on oil and gas production, exploration, and exploitation, as we used to call it. But higher rates on all of these others. How do you explain that? What is it? No. Nope. Yeah?
They spend so much money on current and future projects that they have a ton of tax deductions.
Bingo. That's right. It's purely the result of our tax code that is written to ensure that they pay very little in tax. Essentially, these are purely subsidized by the taxpayers who do pay, by companies that pay more, by people who pay more. These industries would not be the powerhouses they are. We would long ago have moved to other sources of energy, except for the fact that the subsidy through all of these tax loopholes, tax write-offs, tax exemptions that they have, keep them in business. These ancient fossils that are on a life support system, because you look at it right here. You look at it, and you can see, interestingly enough, where the hell is unclassified, zero, okay. Let me get back up here to oil, 2.99, and coal, 0.95. It's all tax. Just special parts of our tax code that give them such low tax rates. And even these aren't the whole story, because of all the corporations now that generate most of their profit on paper offshore. They make their money onshore, but they make their profit offshore, and therefore they don't pay taxes. So this is actually overstating for many of these industries their effective tax rate. But interestingly enough, if you look at this effective tax rate in the right way, what you're looking at is not accounting. And it's actually not really even finance. The distribution of the effective tax rates is sheer political power, pure and simple. Everyone talks about a simplified tax system, but whenever you want to get down to actually saying, we're going to get rid of every tax loophole, everything, on companies and on people, and you're just going to pay a sales tax. Everything is a sales tax. 10%, 8% of your revenue. Oh, then suddenly there is all kinds of screaming about, we'll put all of those coal companies out of business and all those coal miners will be out of business. The oil companies will say, all these oil, you want cheap oil? Well, if you do that, we will charge you out the ass for your oil. You'll be paying $10 a gallon for your oil and all that. So essentially, it's a matter of political power. Shoes, how does the shoe industry utilize power in Washington? Doesn't. What, give them four pairs of Nikes? The point there being that, just as a side note, the after-tax cost of debt, remember, is the before cost of tax of debt, minus the marginal, one times one minus the marginal tax bracket. So the higher this is, the more likely they are to use debt. The lower it is, the less likely they are to use debt. So that first explanation I gave you about why oil is so much equity was really not the whole story at all. The main reason, one of the main reasons anyway, is that when you've got an effective tax rate of 2.91%, 2.91% means that the after-tax cost of debt isn't that much less than the before-tax cost of debt. Therefore, debt is not particularly desirable in the capital structure. That is one of the main reasons you see so little in terms of debt in the capital structure of the oil production, exploration, and exploitation industry. And metals and mining goes right to your point, by the way. It's just a classic example, a lot of subsidy write-off, everything you can write off in the industry and all that kind of stuff. So when you are going through, if you have papers to write, check out this database. It has all kinds of stuff that goes beyond just pure economics and finance and business and goes to the heart of what really makes, shapes a lot of business decision making. It's not business. It's tax policy, the tax code, and the politics that shapes the tax code as it stands in this country now. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.